This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Barber at Touro University in California and Dr. Brian Mann at the University of Alabama. Our topic today will focus on research regarding virtual schools and their growing impact on the American educational landscape. Welcome, Michael and Brian. To begin with, what's meant by the term virtual schools, and what kind of variance does this term encompass?
Virtual schools, the terminology around virtual schools varies significantly. Within the research or academic literature, typically speaking, you'll see the term K-12 online learning used a lot, particularly in recent years, as a general term to refer to all types of online learning that happens at the K-12 level. Virtual schools in most of the research literature tends to mean supplemental programs. So those are programs where you have a student that's enrolled in a physical or brick and mortar kind of school, and they might take one or two courses online just to supplement things that they can't get, or they're scheduling conflicts for those types of things in the classroom. And then we see the term cyber schools used, and those tend to be, at least in the literature, those generally refer to the full-time programs. So these are those ones where the student actually doesn't step foot in a physical school at all and does all of their education over the computer. One of the problems often is that outside of the academic literature, those terms tend to get used interchangeably. So you never really quite know oftentimes what type of program they're referring to. And even within the academic literature, those who are newer to the field or who aren't as familiar with the language and the terms that are used often misuse them as well. So in many cases, you sort of have to look at the description of the type of online school that they're talking about and make your own determination on which of those three kinds of models they're referring to.
So what kinds of organizations are responsible for creating these virtual schools?
If you're looking at the supplemental ones, typically those tend to be run by school districts or in some cases the statewide organizations that oftentimes were either created by or at least approved by the State Department of Education. When it comes to the full-time programs, they're a little different. They oftentimes are set up under charter school legislation and in many cases are actually run by these for-profit corporations. And although you also see school districts that will run these types of programs, nonprofit entities also get involved in that. So it really can be a mixed bag. One of the things that we can say is that with the full-time programs, the vast majority of students attend a full-time, that do go to full-time schools, go to one that is run by a for-profit corporation.
Yeah, I just wanted to add really quick, one of the ways that I feel is useful for in my work of thinking about the kinds of organizations responsible for creating online schools is I like to think about it in two different categories. One would be governance structures. So are they created by statewide virtual schools or school district virtual schools or cyber charter? And the other is content creators. So a lot of times, you know, who governs the program may not necessarily be the organization responsible for creating the content within it. And for that, sometimes that does happen. Sometimes the content is created in-house. And sometimes the content is created. And actually, I should say often the content is created in by an outside private vendor. It's often outsourced to these private vendors. So there's a lot of different ways to slice this question of who's responsible for creating them, depending on if you're talking about who's responsible for governing the school, who's responsible for the teaching and learning involved in the school, who's involved with the curriculum inside of it. So I think those are also some important points to remember when thinking about these different arrangements.
So as an innovation, it really has a multiplicity of different forms.
Now, Brian, in your work, you seem to focus primarily on cyber schools. Can you say more about them?
Yeah, in my work, what I do is I tend to label the schools that I've studied as cyber charter schools. And specifically how I tend to define that are full-time online schools. I've looked a lot at the state of Pennsylvania, so it's this definition corresponds with the law. Full-time online schools that are governed through a charter school governance arrangement. So the school was given a charter to operate. There's a number of, like we've mentioned, there's a number of different types of online schools, but cyber charter schools, some call them online charter schools or virtual charter schools. The work that I've done has mainly looked at those types of programs.
Uh-huh. And Brian actually brings up a good point here that oftentimes it's the legislative regime within a jurisdiction that determines what we call these different things. So as he mentioned, in Pennsylvania, the legislation actually calls them cyber charter schools. And we see a similar thing in Michigan and Wisconsin. If you look in between those jurisdictions in Ohio, the legislation actually calls them e-schools or electronic schools. So that's the term that you would often see used in the media. So what the actual legislation that was passed that initially allowed these things oftentimes determines a lot of the terminology that we use.
So how long have virtual schools been part of the American educational scene, and what kind of growth have they experienced over that time?
The first online school is usually pegged as one that was created by a private school, Laurel Springs School in California. And the date usually given to that is 1991. Most people within the field would actually sort of point to the mid-90s as the real beginning, because that's when we started to see the public programs get involved. So in 96, 97, the Florida Virtual School, which is one of these statewide supplemental programs, as well as the Virtual High School Global Consortium out of Massachusetts, were both created. And from that point, you started to see, at least initially, a lot of these supplemental type programs. While there were a couple of cyber charters before that, the cyber charter activity or the full-time activity really starts to get its beginnings, if you will, around 2000 and 2001. And that's when K-12 Inc. was initially created. Connections, which is the other major company involved in that space, was created a year or two after. In terms of its growth, Tom Clark wrote a report called State of the States back in 2001, and he said that during the previous school year, there were between 40 and 50,000 K-12 students throughout the United States that were doing distance learning of any type, online, otherwise, correspondence, you know, all forms of distance ed. This past year, that number, depending upon whose figures you were looking at, could be somewhere between 3 and 8 million students. So, we've seen a significant growth from that, 40 to 50,000 at the turn of the millennium to right now, we're talking in the millions.
How are these virtual schools paid for?
It depends on the jurisdiction. Some places you will find at least the full-time programs tend to get set up as separate schools. So they get paid by the FTE that you find from that any school would get set up or that any school would get funded by. In other cases, particularly with the supplemental ones, what they often do is they will charge a fee to the home school or the student's, brick and mortar physical school for the student to enroll in them. But even that depends upon the jurisdiction. So if you look at a place like Florida or Utah or Louisiana, where they have these what we call course choice policies, where a student can actually decide that they are going to take, two classes from their physical school. They're going to take another class from the statewide supplemental program. They're going to take another class from one of these cyber charters that are run by a for-profit corporation, and their funding gets divided up by course to whomever is delivering the education. And, you know, Brian can talk a little bit about, you know, the funding of these full-time programs in jurisdictions like Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania is probably a fairly typical model as to how this works.
You know, in a state like Pennsylvania, you know, the funding basically for a cyber charter school, it's kind of a follow the student type model. And so what that means is that when a student goes to a cyber charter school, the district that the student would have enrolled in, their home school district, is responsible for making the tuition payment on behalf of that student. And so in the instance of Pennsylvania, one of the consequences is that the funding has made life, frankly, more difficult for the traditional brick and mortar schools. You know, for example, I just completed a study with a sociologist, Dr. David Baker at Penn State, that's going to be published in the American Journal of Education. And in it, we show in Pennsylvania, like, you know, like it's a little, Pennsylvania is weird because it's a little different than other states because it has such a large cyber charter sector that's been around for a long time. But in this study, in this area, we found that, you know, school districts that have been traditionally educationally disadvantaged, so those that have fewer resources, lower prior levels of adult education in that community. So in other words, kind of the type of districts that need financial support. In this study, we found that those are the districts that are disproportionately funding online learning in the state. And so kind of in a second study, I'm now working on with another colleague, Paul Bruno. He's a PhD student at USC. We see that these charter and cyber charter tuition payments, they're not providing kind of the competitive fire that a lot of the advocates argue for. Instead, simply losing the funds hurt the financial health and the academic performance of schools that are losing the funds. So funding models are really, really important, and I think they're a really instrumental and necessary thing that we should talk about while talking about virtual schools and in this conversation.
It sounds like the virtual schools can actually increase inequity in terms of educational systems and a pretty serious issue. Who is enrolling in virtual schools nationally, and are there any differences in enrollments based on the type or geographic location of the program?
Generally speaking, from a national perspective, one of the things that we can say is that from national statistics, typically speaking, the students that enroll in virtual schools tend to be there tends to be fewer at-risk students. There tends to be fewer special education students. There tends to be fewer minority students, fewer free and reduced lunch students, and a higher proportion of gifted students. Now, that's sort of on a, you know, a national perspective. And the annual reports that the National Education Policy Center every year does sort of highlight that. Now, when you look at it on a state-by-state basis, it really does vary. Luis Herta, myself, and Gary Mirren did a follow-up from the 2017 NEPC Virtual Schools Report. So we essentially used the data from the national report and just looked at how those national trends compared to five individual states, the five states being Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Idaho, and Washington. And, you know, some of those states followed the national trends in terms of, you know, those enrollment patterns, but not every state did. You know, some of the individual states, Ohio was one of them. We saw a higher proportion of special ed students than we did in the national statistics. In the case of Michigan, at least when you look at sort of the demographic characteristics that we can measure, the cyber charter population in Michigan actually mirrored pretty closely the overall population of students in that particular state. So it was fairly representative. You know, Brian can talk a little bit more about what's happening in Pennsylvania. And one of the things I know his work does better than what some of the national studies do, he's actually looked at some of the rural aspects of it as well, which is, you know, this issue of rural, suburban, and urban isn't really touched on in other studies.
Yeah, and just to add, like, I would just like to reiterate, Yeah, that's exactly what I've seen too. And referring to those National Education Policy Center reports, I just want to reiterate, it does differ by state. And I think, you know, looking at the dynamics that you just mentioned, rural, urban, suburban, how those influence enrollment will be important. But I think larger picture, a really big question that we're all kind of working on right now. My research is currently exploring this a bit too, is why do these differences exist? I mean, personally, I think there's a lot of, you know, local history, local context that play into it. But I also think perhaps, you know, the history of a sector, of a cyber charter, an online learning sector in a state, the length of time it's had to develop and the size might relate to why enrollment demographics differ. So, like I mentioned, in Pennsylvania, it's got a long history. It's been around since about 2000. It's a large sector. There's about 40,000 students. And so when you look at Pennsylvania's enrollments, it doesn't match. It doesn't align with the national trends. But, you know, Pennsylvania and also Ohio and maybe Michigan, they're a little bit different in terms of their development than the national trends. So I think it'll be really interesting to follow this over the next few and maybe several years, because if cyber charter schooling, if that model or other virtual school models expand in other states, we might see the enrollment demographics change in those states. And so as the online learning sectors and the types of online learning expand. So I think it'll be really interesting and important to look at. Pennsylvania, like I said, is not representative, but it is in terms of enrollment, but it's also different in terms of history, rural versus urban context. And like I mentioned earlier, because of this history and because of enrollments, there's a lot of inequity that is happening in online learning in Pennsylvania.
Who teaches in these virtual schools? And is there any special training offered to prepare them for working in this kind of educational environment?
In terms of who teaches, it really does depend upon the state legislation that created these kinds of programs. So in terms of the full-time programs, some states require that it be a certified teacher. Other states, the regulations around that are a little bit more relaxed, although I'll be honest and say that the majority of states do require a certified teacher. The actual teachers that teach in these environments vary significantly. Some are folks that, you know, decided that they wanted to teach in the online environment and have really spent most of their careers there. Others are folks that were disillusioned with the classroom space and moved to that environment. When you're looking at the supplemental schools, typically speaking, those tend to be classroom teachers that are involved in these. But the other issue that you have when you ask about, you know, who's teaching in these environments is, you know, who is considered the teacher? You know, if you look at, say, a full-time environment, you know, you've got an online teacher that never sees the student. And in many cases, these teachers have a much higher student-teacher ratio than you would find in a brick-and-mortar environment. And you've got someone who's designed the actual course content, which, you know, plays a big role in actually educating the kid. For that matter, all of these environments actually require what they call a learning coach, which typically is the parent or the guardian. And they're actually instrumental in the instructional process. And, you know, if you think about your typical parent or guardian of a K-12 kid, let's face it, the vast majority of them don't have, you know, any sort of teaching credentials or teaching background. In the supplemental environment, while you don't have a learning coach, oftentimes you have some kind of school-based facilitator that is there for the student when they're engaged in their online learning. In some cases, those are teachers. In other cases, they're paraprofessionals or other personnel in the school. To the second part of your question about the training that's offered, for the most part, there is no formal training. There aren't, for the most part, degrees in online teaching. A number of universities have created these graduate certificates at the, the master's level. And there are some schools that have put in place opportunities to gain some experience in this environment. but most of them aren't done in a formal way. And there isn't necessarily required professional development for these, at least not at the state level, although many of the individual programs do both provide and require that professional development of those folks that teach there.
I just wanted to add one, I think, important little nugget of information related to this is that in teacher prep programs, often the most valuable experience that students get at the college level is their student teaching field placement. And there's been a little bit of work that's looked to see if there's been field placements in online schools. And for the most part, this has not happened. I think the last I checked and the last the study looked at, only 3 or 4% of College of Educations have offered any kind of placement of students into an online K-12 online setting, which if you think about it, you know, in a state like Pennsylvania, if they're hired for a cyber charter school, that's their full-time online job. They're not trained ahead of time. And so I think that's a really important, consideration moving forward.
Given all of this, what has research shown about the effectiveness of these schools?
Well, I was just going to, however you want to start, because I know we both have plenty to say about this.
Yeah, I mean, I guess similar to the enrollment type question, it really does vary significantly from type of program to individual programs. I can tell you from a systematic perspective at the national level, the latest NEPC report only came out earlier this week, at least from the time that we're recording this, and it found that, you know, these programs, in terms of the number of them that were actually meeting the state standards, was significantly lower than what their brick and mortar counterparts were, or even their blended counterparts for that matter. But again, within an individual state, you might have one or two programs that are doing incredibly well. And unfortunately, we don't really have patterns of this. So we can't say that programs that operate like X and Y will do good and, you know, others don't do that well. We do have some trends that we can say. Typically speaking, programs that are full-time and have a statewide focus tend not to perform that well. Those that seem to be run by for-profit educational management organizations as a whole, when we look at the national data, tend not to do that well. In many cases, we find that students in the online environment tend to fall further behind than what they were when they left the brick and mortar environment. Although, again, there are specific programs that are the exception to that.
Yeah, and I just want to add a little bit to that. So Michael and I just recently wrote a report that is soon to be released by UCEA's Center for the Advanced Study of Technology, Leadership and Education. And in our report, we summarize a lot of these studies that talk about the academic effectiveness of full-time virtual schools. And like Michael said, there are programs out there that do amazing work. And, you know, I've personally met with folks from these programs and at times come away, you know, highly impressed. But while the success stories do exist, you know, as we show in our report and other studies, studies on the performance of especially the full-time virtual programs, the statewide programs, the cyber charter programs, shows that they're not doing that well. So, I mean, in terms of metrics, I mean, this is on metrics from academic growth, proficiency ratings, graduation, attrition, dropout, like almost anything you look at, a lot of the design of these online programs right now has led to a lot of these programs to really, really struggle.
So given their poor record, what have either state or federal regulators done to make virtual schools more accountable to the public for the quality of the education that they provide for their students?
Unfortunately, I have to say very little. If you look at the types of legislation that have been passed in state houses right across the nation, one of the things that you'll find, really the only trend that we see, is one that allows for increased growth, the one that allows for fewer sort of regulatory oversight. So the legislation has typically been looking at how do we open up more markets for these folks and how do we remove as many regulations as we can so that they can be innovative. And in many cases, it's the companies that are behind these programs that through advocacy groups that they're involved in, through organizations like the American Legislative Exchange Council or ALEC, the model legislation that they put forth in various state houses across the country. They've really lobbied for these kinds of things in a significant way. And while we've seen sort of the number of states that are opening these kinds of programs and the growth of these programs starting to slow down, we haven't seen any real legislation that's designed to increase the accountability of this. And, that's disheartening.
So given the fact that these schools seem to be pretty ineffective and that there's so little accountability, why do you think that they're growing in numbers so much?
One thing I was just going to say is, I think this is something we should really think about. I mean, there's two main things I would like to say. One is, I think, in some communities, in some places, there are people who are, they're desperate and they're in trying circumstances in their home community. So, they might be in situations where the support for public institutions in general have waned. The economies, recessions, things like that have hit. And I think there are people in certain parts of the country that are desperate to try something that they perceive is kind of the latest and greatest thing. A lot of times they're in areas where their traditional schools are underfunded and they weren't working for them. And so they're looking to try something new. And I also think that this is coming at the same time. And this is kind of the second part of a growing logic of markets and choice and innovativeness. And they're kind of driving people, policymakers and folks to implement new models of schooling. So when you have these two things coming together, I think you have a logic of markets meeting in some senses a logic of desperation. And to me, the shame is like in the regard to a lot of virtual school programs, I don't think people are getting what they thought they were getting. And I think that the market's kind of not delivering on its promise. And so that would be one thing. Another thing I think is also important is, and this is just broader picture, and I'm sure Michael can add to some of these thoughts as well, is that, policy matters and, implementation matters. And, organizations make decisions, governments make decisions, and then allowing, some of these types of K-12 Inc. or other big online learning vendors who have a lot of money to market and advertise and to sell a school. I think they are highly effective in getting their message. And if you want to put it this way, their product out there. And so I think you're seeing kind of a combination of forces at play. And a lot of this is from my experience in Pennsylvania and also a little bit in Alabama, but mainly Pennsylvania. So you see a combination of forces that lead to students and families trying new things. There's a number of other reasons for enrollment that are more specific that are at times pretty compelling. And I'll just let Michael add to kind of some of those thoughts.
Actually, I think you've summarized it quite well, Brian.
Great.
Thanks.
close to our time. So I appreciate what you've shared with us, Michael and Brian, about what you've learned about online schools, an innovation that clearly needs to be more studied and regulated than it currently is. This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center. This podcast concludes our series for this academic year, but it will start up again in September. We encourage you to rejoin us for more podcasts about critical educational issues and the people who study them.